Chapter 4. Supper, all the world at Oldborough, ate very greedily of those two substantial dishes, and the mayor's wife became from that day forth a mortal enemy of the Gorgons. For, sitting near her ladyship, who refused the proffered soup and meat, the mayoress thought herself obliged to follow this disagreeable example. She sent away the plate of turtle with a sigh, saying, however, to the baronet's lady, "I thought, ma'am, that the Lord Mayor of London always had turtle to his supper? And what if he didn't, Biddy?" Said his honor the mayor, "A good thing's a good thing, and here goes." Wherewith he plunged his spoon into the savory mess. The mayoress, as we have said, dared not, but she hated Lady Gorgon, and remembered it at the next election. The pride, in fact, and insolence of the Gorgon party rendered every person in the room hostile to them. So soon as, gorged with meat, they began to find that courage which Britons invariably derive from their victuals. The show of the Gorgon plate seemed to offend the people. The Gorgon champagne was a long time, too, in making its appearance. Arrive, however, it did. The people were waiting for it. The young ladies, not accustomed to that drink, declined pledging their admirers until it was produced. The men too, despised the Bucellas and sherry, and were looking continually towards the door. At last, Mr. Rinser, the landlord, Mr. Hawk, Sir George's butler, and sundry others entered the room. Bang! Went the corks fizz, the foamy liquor sparkled into all sorts of glasses that were held out for its reception. Mr. Hawk helped Sir George and his party, who drank with great gusto. The wine which was administered to the persons immediately around Mr. Scully was likewise pronounced to be good. But Mr. Perkins, who had taken his seat among the humbler individuals, and in the very middle of the table, observed that all these persons, after drinking, made to each other very wry and ominous faces, and whispered much. He tasted his wine. It was a villainous compound of sugar, vitriol, soda water, and green gooseberries. At this moment a great clatter of forks was made by the president's and vice president's party. Silence for a toast was silence all. "Landlord," said Mr. Perkins, starting up the rogue, "where did his impudence come from? Have you any champagne of your own?" "Silence! Down!" roared the Tories, the ladies looking aghast. "Silence, sit down you," shrieked the well-known voice of the general. "I beg your pardon, general," said young John Perkins, "but where could you have bought this champagne? My worthy friend, I know, is going to propose the ladies. Let us at any rate drink such a toast and good wine. Here, here. Drink her ladyship's health in this stuff. I declare to goodness I would sooner drink it in beer." No pen can describe the uproar which arose. The anguish of the Gorgonites, the shrieks, jeers, cheers, ironic cries of "wipes," etc., which proceeded from the less genteel, but more enthusiastic Scullyites. "This vulgarity is too much," said Lady Gorgon, rising, and Mrs. Mayoress and the ladies of the party did so too. The general, two squires, the clergyman, the Gorgon apothecary and attorney, with their respective ladies, followed her. They were plainly beaten from the field. Such of the Tories as dared remained, and in inglorious compromise shared the jovial Whig feast. "Gentlemen and ladies," hiccuped Mr. Heeltop, "I'll give you a toast. Champagne to our real Hick friends, apostrophe no, real champagne to our friends, apostrophe and Hick poo. Champagne to our friends, and real pain to our enemies, apostrophe huzzay." The Scully faction on this day bore the victory away, and if the polite reader has been shocked by certain vulgarities on the part of Mr. Scully and his friends, he must remember imprimis that Oldborough was an inconsiderable place, that the inhabitants thereof were chiefly tradespeople, not of refined habits, that Mr. Scully himself had only for 3 months mingled among the aristocracy, that his young friend Perkins was violently angry, and finally, and to conclude, that the proud vulgarity of the great Sir George Gorgon and his family was infinitely more odious and contemptible than the mean vulgarity of the Scullyites and their leader. Immediately after this event, Mr. Scully and his young friend Perkins returned to town. The latter to his garrets in Bedford Row, the former to his apartments on the first floor of the same house. He lived here to superintend his legal business. His London agents, Messrs. Hicks, Biggs, and Blatherwick, occupying the ground floor, the junior partner, Mr. Gustavus Blatherwick, the second flat of the house. Scully made no secret of his profession or residence. He was an attorney, and proud of it. He was the grandson of a laborer, and thank God for it. He had made his fortune by his own honest labor, and why should he be ashamed of it? And now, having explained at full length who the several heroes and heroines of this history were, and how they conducted themselves in the country, let us describe their behavior in London, and the great events which occurred there. You must know that Mr. Perkins bore away the tenderest recollections of the young lady with whom he had danced at the Oldborough Ball, and, having taken particular care to find out where she dwelt when in the metropolis, managed soon to become acquainted with Aunt Biggs, and made himself so amiable to that lady that she begged he would pass all his disengaged evenings at her lodgings in Caroline Place. Mrs. Biggs was perfectly aware that the young gentleman did not come for her bohea and muffins, so much as for the sweeter conversation of her niece, Miss Gorgon. But seeing that these two young people were of an age when ideas of love and marriage will spring up, do what you will, seeing that her niece had a fortune, and Mr. Perkins had the prospect of a place, and was moreover a very amiable and well-disposed young fellow, she thought her niece could not do better than marry him, and Miss Gorgon thought so too. Now the public will be able to understand the meaning of that important conversation which is recorded at the very commencement of this history. Lady Gorgon and her family were likewise in town. But, when in the metropolis, they never took notice of their relative, Miss Lucy. The idea of acknowledging an ex-schoolmistress living in Mecklenburg Square being much too preposterous for a person of my Lady Gorgon's breeding and fashion. She did not, therefore, know of the progress which Sly Perkins was making all this while, for Lucy Gorgon did not think it was at all necessary to inform her ladyship how deeply she was smitten by the wicked young gentleman who had made all the disturbance at the Oldborough Ball. The intimacy of these young persons had, in fact, become so close that on a certain sunshiny Sunday in December, after having accompanied Aunt Biggs to church, they had pursued their walk as far as that rendezvous of lovers, the Regent's Park, and were talking of their coming marriage, with much confidential tenderness, before the bears in the zoological gardens. Miss Lucy was ever and anon feeding those interesting animals with buns, to perform which act of charity as he had clambered upon the parapet which surrounds their den. Mr. Perkins was below, and Miss Lucy, having distributed her buns, was on the point of following, but whether from timidity, or whether from a desire to do young Perkins an essential service, I know not. However, she found herself quite unwilling to jump down unaided. "My dearest John," said she, "I never can jump that." Whereupon John stepped up, put one hand round Lucy's waist, and as one of hers gently fell upon his shoulder, Mr. Perkins took the other and said, "Now jump." Hoop. Jump she did, and so excessively active and clever was Mr. John Perkins, that he jumped Miss Lucy plump into the middle of a group formed of Lady Gorgon, the Mrs. Gorgon, Master George Augustus Frederick Grimsby Gorgon, and a footman, poodle, and French governess, who had all been for 2 or 3 minutes listening to the billings and cooings of these imprudent young lovers. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.